study through the book of Ecclesiastes is The Life Worth Living. And the title of this specific teaching today, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, is the same, The Life Worth Living. However, a better title for the book of Ecclesiastes would be The Life Not Worth Living. Because Ecclesiastes doesn't look at things from the positive. It doesn't say this is how you ought to be living and it would be so good if you did this and so good if you did that. And it would be such a positive thing and keep on going and you guys can do it and you guys are the ones and you're the man, you're the woman, you know, you're all it and go. Not that kind of thing at all. Getting a bit carried away there, wasn't I? It's not that kind of thing at all. It's not that kind of a positive presentation. In fact, this book is incredibly negative. It pictures life apart from Christ, full of empty pursuits that can never satisfy you. Solomon to Solomon, it is not the power of positive thinking. Solomon wouldn't like the conferences or the seminars on thinking positively. To Solomon, it was, what's the use? You are about to study 11 of the most negative chapters in the next 2.5 months that you could possibly ever study, only to be followed by chapter 12 in the book of Ecclesiastes, which reveals one of the greatest secrets for a life that is lived with meaning. He spends 11 chapters saying, it's not worth it. Life is a drag. In fact, he says life is a series of drags. You go from one drag to another drag to another drag to another drag. But in the end, he gives us the key to what makes it all worthwhile. Solomon describes life in the first 11 chapters as a rat race. He describes it as looking at the earth and looking at an anthill. As you see the ants come out and carrying their little thing and putting it down and go back in and putting it down and going back in. He describes the earth as that kind of a life. Men are moving to and fro and they're doing what they're doing. But what are they doing? You look down at an anthill and you think, what's all that about? You're annoyed that they're on your driveway, so you scatter them around only to find it rebuilt the very next day. I can't believe they did it again. You kick it again. You poison it or you pour hot oil on it. And next thing you know, it's over here. Now, you know, on your driveway, a little bit over the other way. He pictures life as the rat race, as the grind. As I said last week, life as blah, 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 blah. The thing is that Solomon isn't alone. The writer Thoreau said, most men live a life of quiet desperation. Solomon would have been good friends with Murphy. Everything that can go wrong will go wrong. In fact, you and I live lives of examples of that, don't we? It's funny, as I've made mention of that in the sermons preceding this, everybody's agreeing, they're nodding their heads. Isn't that our lives? It just seems like one thing goes wrong after another thing goes wrong after another thing goes wrong. And in that, you would agree with Solomon about life. Solomon was the original Murphy. He was the original Eeyore on Winnie the Pooh. It's my birthday, nobody cares. I lost my tail, can't find my tail. Everything's bad, everything's horrible. Life is bad. That's Solomon. You might think that Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes while he was in midlife crisis. That he went through what he went through in his life. He tried to achieve many things. And then at the end, he stopped and he looked back at a certain point in his life and he said, isn't there more to life? And so he took a couple buttons down on his priestly robe. He put on a couple of chains, his chest hair. Hello, a little gray chest hair hanging out. Hello, how are you? Bought himself a sports chariot, put mags on it, went cruising down by the university. Hey, toupee. Kind of flapping in the wind. But I don't believe that Solomon wrote this out of a midlife crisis. He may very well have written it after a midlife crisis. When after he had tried to maintain his youth, after he had tried to hang on at something before it all slipped away and looked back at it all and said, none of it at all, anything that I have done has ever been worthwhile. And you got to think about that. If Solomon, the king of Israel, who achieved everything that he could achieve, who had fame and power, who had successes beyond measure, they're going to be listed through the book of Ecclesiastes one by one by one by one by one. If he says, none of it has been worth it, then you and I go, well, then what is our lives worth? In fact, that is the point that he ends up making here. Another pessimist said, life is a series of tragedies that is connected by the grind. It's one tragedy after another, and in between the tragedies, life just goes on. It's one load of laundry after another load of laundry after another load of laundry that never seems to finish. My wife, I told you earlier, my wife and my daughter are in Ireland now, and so I'm taking care of my two boys. And I'm doing laundry after laundry after laundry. And here a couple of days ago, actually, I think it was this morning, I saw one of my sons, and I won't tell you which one, pick up a shirt and smell it to see if it was okay for him to be able to wear. And I realized I'm probably neglecting my duties when it comes to laundry. But no wonder when my wife is in town, the, you know, wash machine never stops for a family of five. It always seems, you know, I need to wash something. I open it up and there's always something in the wash machine. And then I'm going to put it over in the dryer and I open that up and there's always something in the dryer. And I tell my wife, how come I can never wash any clothes? She says, because I'm washing stuff. Life is just this grind that seems to go on and on. We do what we do only to do it again, only to do it again, only to do it again, and only to do it again. And that's the picture that Solomon sets up. I believe that the church today needs a good dose of the book of Ecclesiastes, because I believe that the church today is too fond of this world. The church today is too fond of life apart from God. The church today has turned into, to a large degree, by the way, not 100%, but to a large degree, the church today has turned into some kind of a self-help seminar that's ongoing. You want your life a little better? Let's go to church. You want to learn how to be a better father, better mother? You want to learn how to be a better parent? You want to learn how to have a better family? You want to learn how your life can be better and fulfilled? You can be happy and you can be satisfied with your life? Then come to church. I had someone, after speaking on this particular topic a while ago, someone came up to me afterwards and says, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with us coming to church and talking about family? What's wrong with us talking about how to raise kids or how to be a better wife or how to be a better husband? And the answer to that is, nothing's wrong with that, if that's what you want. But that's not what church is about. Church is about worship of the living God. Church is about us committing ourselves to the one who created us and us focusing our lives and our attention upon him. It's not about us coming and seeing a skit about parenthood and then saying, wow, now I'm a better parent, but never talking about Jesus and never talking about God and never talking about commitment and never living for him. And as I've said before, if that's what you want out of church, then this is not the place to be, because that is not what we're about. You need to go find another place if that's what you want. See, too much of Christianity is about patching up the old life. You say, here's my life, Lord. I generally like my life. I like where I'm going. I like the comfort I've been able to achieve, or I like what I do. I like my hobby. Here's my life. But God, there's a couple problems with my life. There's a couple holes in my boat, my life. Could you patch them up for me? Lord, if I come to you and ask you into my life, will you patch it up? Just come along and boink, 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 and there float my life down. So I've invited God in and God has made my life better. I went down to the bookstore, the Barnes and Nobles, and walked around the Christian section. Went down to one of the Christian bookstores here in town and just walked around the applied Christianity. And as I walked around these different sections here, I just began to notice that most of the books were of this self-help variety, especially the top sellers, were how to make your life better. And I won't give you any titles of the names of the books that are out there, but most of them were along those lines. And I began to think, has the church just settled into this? Where it's all, you know, you might as a preacher, hey, you might as well be a, you know, seminar, positive speaker, seminar kind of a guy. Might as well be something, just come in and motivate people to live their lives a little bit better and a little bit better. But see, that's not what Jesus said. Jesus didn't say, I want to take your life that's basically good in your eyes. I want to patch it up and help you float it down the river. He didn't say that. He said, I want to sink your boat. I want you to give up your life. I want you to lay it down. I want you to stop living for yourself. I want you to deny yourself. I want you to give your life up completely for me. And then I'm going to give you a whole new boat. Wah! And here's the boat that he brings along. And he says, this is what I want you to live. He didn't say, I came to make your life better. He said, I came to give you life and life more abundantly. Paul said in Galatians, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I that live, but it is Christ that lives in me. See, Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes is telling us, your life isn't worth living. You will go on and on and on and on. It's giant circle. You're doing everything that you do every day. You wake up one day and you're 20 and beautiful, and you wake up the next day and you're 60 and scary. Things have just changed, and you're especially scary before you do anything to yourself. When you wake up and look in the mirror and, whoa, man, look at that. What happened to me? Your life just goes and you say, where did it go? And what does it all mean? That's why people go into midlife crisis. Because all of a sudden they look and they realize they don't have much longer to live, and they say, what's it all been about? I've spent my life working, I've spent my life putting these things together, but what does my life mean? And when the answer is nothing, they don't know what to do. They begin to grasp for their youth in some other way. Well, that's Solomon as he writes this book. It is 11 chapters of pessimism. It is 11 chapters of life is just a grind. Men's lives are full of sorrow. It's full of tragedy, and it's full of difficulties. But in the last chapter, I don't want to give it away again, he gets to the point where he begins to share that which is really important. Now in chapter 1, we're going to study it verse by verse. We're going to go through all 18 verses. But there are three phrases here that I have found, and I've highlighted two of them, and there's one more in here that you could highlight or you could underline. And I'm not going to tell you what these phrases are. They're phrases that give us the key to what Ecclesiastes is all about. I'm not going to give them to you. While we're going through here, look for them, get your pen and pencil out, and underline it. At the end, I'll come back and tell you what I found and what I've underlined, and why I believe that that is the key to understanding the book of Ecclesiastes. And if you don't get that key, then you will just be one depressed individual once you're done with the book of Ecclesiastes. You will just say, then what is life all about? If this is God's word, what is life all about if you don't get that key? First of all, we're told who the author is in verse 1 and verse 12, by the way, of chapter 1. It says the words of the preacher. The word for preacher there doesn't mean preacher as in pastor, teacher kind of thing. It just means speaker. Solomon's saying, I'm a speaker. I'm going to address you now. He says, I've got something to say. I want to give you a seminar on life. This would not be a well-attended seminar, by the way. He wouldn't be able to come on and say, I'm giving my power of positive thinking seminar. And he would have to say, I'm giving my power of negative life seminar. Come out and discover it. Nobody would go. Verse 1, in fact, nobody reads Ecclesiastes because you get halfway through it and you think, what a drag. Verse 1, the words of the preacher, the speaker, the son of David, the king of Jerusalem, whom we know was Solomon. Then he gives us right away into the book. He lets us know in verse 2 what it's all about. No, count it. How many times does he say this? Vanity of vanities, says the preacher or the speaker. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. 5 times in verse 2. If you're, you know, somehow a little dense and you didn't get what this is going to be about, 5 times he said it. Vanity, 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 vanity. It's all worthless, 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 worthless. One translation, popular translation, by the way, says popcorn, popcorn, says the preacher. Popcorn, popcorn, everything is popcorn. You ever gone to a movie hungry, tried to fill up on popcorn, only to leave and say, I gotta have something else. I'm just miserable, I'm bloated, and I need some food, protein, something. One translation says cotton candy, says the speaker. Cotton candy, everything's cotton candy. You know, when your kids have cotton candy at the ballpark and you look down at it, you want a piece of it, and you look, some, most of it's slimed up and all wet and kind of, because they've licked their fingers, and you finally find a piece to take and you eat it and it melts in your mouth. It's pretty good. But how come you don't order cotton candy when you go to Tony Roma's to eat? Or how come you don't order cotton candy when you find yourself at a restaurant and it's not on the menu? Because cotton candy can never satisfy you and it can never fulfill you. You may live your life full of cotton candy, cotton candy, cotton candy, cotton candy, but in the end you're going to say, this is not worth anything. This has no substance. I need something else in my life. And so he begins. And he gives us through the course of this, really basically 3 arguments. He says, first of all, life goes on and on and on and on and on and doesn't stop. The second thing that he says is, there is nothing new. Might think you discover nothing new, but there's nothing new. And then again, nothing ever changes. Everything stays the same. First thing he says here is in verse 3. What profit has a man from all of his labor, in which he toils under the sun? Guys, I don't know how many years you've worked. You get to a certain point in life and you begin to look ahead a little bit. You begin to say, I'm about to retire. I'm going to retire. I'm going to get this together and that together, and I'm going to retire. You know that if you work 40 hours a week, some of you work more, some of you work less, but some of you work more than 40 hours a week. If you work 40 a week, you spend 2,000 hours a year working. If you have a job where you watch the clock, that was 2,000 hours last year. Click, 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 as you watch the clock. If you work from 20 years old until retirement age, you will work 93,600 hours. Now, that's a lot of watching the clock. 93,000 hours. If you make an average of $15 an hour, you would make $1.5 million in your lifetime. And you look back on your life and you say, what has it all been about? See, that's his point. His point, first of all, is you've got this labor, and what profit is there? Then he gives his examples. He says, one generation passes away and another generation comes, and the earth abides forever. He's not making a theological statement there, by the way, that the earth abides forever. His point is, we have one generation after another generation, and when you guys are gone, there'll be another church, maybe the same one with somebody else here, and people at church again. And then the next generation, the next generation, and the next generation. One comes and goes and comes and goes, and we might think we're significant, that we have a significant generation, but another one follows to take our place. The sun arises, it says in verse 5, and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. It goes up and down and around again to the beginning, up and down and around again to the beginning, up and down and around again to the beginning. And you think, boy, I got all these years to live and all these days to live. And the next thing you know, you look back and go, where'd they all go? The sun has just gone around and around and around and around and around and around. Then he says in verse 6, the wind goes towards the south. It turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again in its circuit. The wind is just constantly blowing. You walk outside, the wind is in your face. It's always going around. Now, Solomon here speaks of circuits, wind circuits. And a lot has been made about, you know, Solomon's knowledge and understanding the fact that wind has currents. Because nobody wrote of currents in his day. They just saw the wind coming from one direction and didn't speak of wind circuits. And you and I know, scientists know, that the wind moves on circuits. But again, that's not Solomon's point. Solomon's not trying to say to you, look how smart I am, that, you know, 1,000 years before Christ, I understood wind currents. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, look, the sun goes up and down, up and down, up and down. The wind, round and around and around. You straighten your hair, you straighten your hair, you straighten your hair, and you straighten your hair, and you straighten your hair. The wind blesses it up. Then verse 7, all the rivers run into the sea, and the sea is never full. The water evaporates out of the river and falls on the mountains, or evaporates out of the ocean, falls on the mountains, comes in the rivers back to the sea, evaporates up, falls on the mountains, comes back to the sea. At the same time, the wind's blowing, and the sun's going up and down and up and down all around. And then verse 8, and all things are full of labor. There's the sun going around and the wind going around and the water raining down on your working and you're sweating and you're working and you're sweating. And all of this time is passing. You get the picture that Solomon's drawing? He's drawing a life that is just going on, a life where people are working to just exist, to just be, to just make it. And in the end, he's going to say, what's all that for? What's all that worth if that's all that life is? He goes on to say here, all things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is never satisfied with seeing, and the ear full of hearing. You see something, and then you just want to see it again. You hear something, you just want to hear it again. You do something, and you just want to do it again. You're never satisfied. It's never enough. You make a certain amount of money, and you want to make more money. You heard here a couple of months ago, maybe it was 3 or 4 months ago now, about the billionaire who boarded his private plane from a particular island, and he was arrested as he boarded the plane. And he was sentenced to, I forget what it was, you know, or he's got the possibility of being sentenced to 12 to 15 years, maybe even life in prison because he tried to embezzle while he was there at this particular island. And you wonder, what does a billionaire have to embezzle money for? He's a billionaire, but he has to get more. When are you satisfied with what you've got? As soon as you buy a new car, you want a new one. As soon as you buy a new car, the next year model comes out. Look at that one. That one's got a different dash. I like that dash better than I like my dash. You go on vacation, you have a 2-week vacation, you're gone for a week and you can't wait to get home. Okay, I gotta just get back home. You get back to the same rat race you left, and within a week you plan your next vacation for the following year. It's a constant looking forward to something because nothing ever satisfies us where we are. It's always got to be something else. You're out on the golf course, and as soon as you get done, you can't wait till you're back out on the golf course again. You ride your bike, your cycle, and as soon as you're finished, you can't wait until you can get out and ride your cycle again. It's like it's never satisfied. You're never full. Verse 9, that which has been done is what will be done, and that which is done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? You might say, well, technology's brought a lot of new things about. But see, men have been discovering things for generations. So in reality, it's nothing new. Men have been discovering things. Technology has always been growing, and they've always been doing it. And in reality, there is nothing new. Men discover and go on, and life in the next generation is going to be very much like our life. People will get married, and people will get divorced, and people will have struggles, and people will have tragedies. People will go through their lives. It has already been in ancient times before us, he says. There is no remembrance of the former things. Even the things we remember about the former things, history. And you know, history professors will tell you this as well. You really can't trust history. You know, we go in history and we act like, oh, we know all about what history is. But the people who write history are the conquerors in the past. And they rewrote history their way. So that you can't even really trust history. Even recent history is redone. We have history revisionists today. Everybody wants to take the founding fathers and, you know, rework them to the way whatever their view is, rather than saying, who were these people? And what were they about in history? Everybody wants to rewrite it all. There's no remembering of the former things. And after the former things are presented, you go, I don't even know if I can really trust the former things that were presented. It goes on to say, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come. After everything is all said and done, people won't remember it. Look at our lives and we think, oh man, I'm cooking now. I'm doing some significant things. And in the years to come, people are going to say, who? Robert, who? What? But those who will come after. There will be no remembrance of any who will come after this. Then he says, I, the speaker, was the king of Israel, Jerusalem. He's saying, I'm the king of Israel. And I realize that in years to come, people are going to say, who? What was Solomon all about? I set my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, the burdensome task that God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. I set my heart to know wisdom, and I looked at the burdensome task that God has given men. They're just out there working. They're just out there laboring. They're just out there having a difficult time making ends meet. And I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping after the wind. I've seen everything that men have set out to do, and in the end, it's all worthless. What a perfect picture, grasping after the wind, reaching out, trying to catch the wind, an impossibility. You say, well, I can use my life to make someone else's life better. And it says, but what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. In other words, you might be able to straighten things out for a while. You may be able to, you know, pick up a rock and carry it to the top of the ant pile and put it down and help the collective community for a moment, but everything goes back. It's a matter of men's heart. It's not a matter of the environment that we're around. It's the matter of men's hearts. Verse 16, I communed with my heart saying, look, I have attained greatness. He looked around him and he said, I have become a great man. And certainly Solomon had. We saw that last week. I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. He had said earlier, I gained wisdom and understanding. He learned from the books of his day. He had sought academics. He had sought wisdom. He says, and that too was folly. He says, my heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. I have set my heart to know wisdom, to know madness, and to know folly. He says, I set my heart to know wisdom and understanding, and I saw that that was vanity, so I lived like an idiot. I just went out living like an idiot, saying it doesn't matter, no understanding, I'm just going to be an idiot. And he was an idiot, and he was a fool. And he says of all of those, of wisdom, of knowledge, of madness, living like an idiot, of folly, he says, I set my heart to know wisdom, to know madness, to know folly, and I perceived that this also is grasping after the wind. Are you depressed yet? Well, let's read verse 18. For in much wisdom is much grief, and in the increase of knowledge is the increase of sorrow. Man's born for grief, is what he's saying. Another passage in the book of Proverbs tells us that with much knowledge comes much sorrow. The more you learn about what men face and what men go through, the more sorrow you have, the more grief you have. So you grow and you increase in knowledge and you learn about what men are going through, and there's grief. And certainly that's true. My grandfather died a few years ago. He had smoked all of his life. Camel filterless is what he had smoked. He was 70 years old and he was dying of emphysema. And I remember thinking shortly after that, I wonder, had he not smoked, how many more years my grandfather would have had. But I was sitting by my grandfather's bed and I was holding his hand, and my grandfather would look over and see me there, kind of coming in and out of consciousness, or coming in and out of coherentness, really. Not just conscious, but just being coherent about what was going on around him. And he would look over and he'd see me there, his grandson. His eyes would well up with tears. The tears would run down his face. And I would try to talk to him, even though he couldn't respond much at that point. And I had no idea really what was going through his mind as he looked at me and as he began to cry. But I thought of that passage as I sat there next to my grandfather. With much age comes much sorrow. The older we get, the more we see life, the more things we've experienced, the more people die. You guys that are older than me, you know that more than I know that. You guys, you say, yeah, that's right. It seems that everybody around us, you know, it's the constant, whenever you run into an old friend, it's constantly, did you hear about this so-and-so? Did you hear about this? Did you hear about the cancer? Did you hear about the car wreck? Did you hear about this person that died and that person that died? It's amazing how many people that we used to know and hang around with are gone now. So what's it all worth? We look at Solomon and go, okay, Solomon, you've done your job. We're depressed. Life is a giant cycle that goes around and around and around, but he gave us three clues as we made our way through. Did you underline them? Did you note them? Did you mark it? Look first of all at the very end of verse 9. There is nothing new under the sun. See, there's nothing new under the sun, but there's all kinds of new things above the sun. Look at the end of verse 13, chapter 1 again. It says, all that is done under heaven. He says, I set my mind to know everything that was done under heaven, but there's a whole other world that's above heaven or in heaven. Then the very next verse, he says, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. And so he gives us a clue here. I've set my mind and my heart on everything that man does and all the things that he's doing upon this earth that is apart from living for God in heaven. It's interesting to compare Solomon to Jeremiah. Both of them were pessimistic. Both of them are the pessimists of the Bible. Solomon, of course, you see his pessimism here in Ecclesiastes. And Jeremiah, you see it in all of his writings. He wrote the book of Lamentations. He wrote the book of Jeremiah, which is full of tears. He was known as the weeping prophet. He constantly cried for Jerusalem, cried for Israel because of what they were going through. Jeremiah, though, said, when I saw the sun, I saw the greatness of my God. When Solomon saw the sun, he said, I looked at everything that was under the sun. Solomon had his focus on everything that was under the sun, and he said, all of it is vanity, 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 all that is under the sun. But Jeremiah said, I saw the greatness of God above the sun. In other words, God comes along in our lives, and he says, I don't just want to patch up your life so you can go out and live this life and go through the routine and be involved in the rat race and build the ant pile of humanity so somebody else can come along later on and do it. God says, I want your life. That's why Jesus said, if you seek to save your life, you'll lose it. But if you lose your life, give it up for my sake, you'll save it. It's why Paul said, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I that live. It is Christ that lives in me. Our only hope is to say, I am done living for myself. I will not live my life for the rat race. I will not live my life in going after one thing after another. I will live my life for my God. I will surrender myself to him. From 14 to 19, I was a Christian, but I had this kind of self-help mentality during that time. And I will never forget the prayer that I prayed at 19 years old when I said to the Lord, and these were my exact words, all right, God, I'm done. I'm done living for myself. I'm ready to live for you. And I will serve you in obscurity, and I'll serve you in greatness. I don't care. In other words, I was saying to God, doesn't matter what you do with me. If you have me minister to one person or to thousands, I don't care. I'm done. I'm no longer living my life for me, I'm living it for you. A few months ago, I'm driving down the road, and the Lord reminded me of that particular prayer in my life. And by the way, that was a huge transformation in my life. That was a bigger transformation in my life than when I got saved at 14 years old. When I finally said to God, okay, I'm done. I'm not living for Robert Furrow anymore. I'm living for you. My life is yours. God reminded me of that just a few months ago, and he spoke to my heart again. And he said, are you still willing to go anywhere I want you to go? And I said, yeah. And God goes, no, really. See, we answer that quickly, don't we? Will you go anywhere I want you to go? You bet, God. You bet. Here I am in Tucson. Love it, man. Church is going great. Loving the people that are here. Developing relationships. It's just awesome. Things are going great. God says, what if I asked you to leave and go to some island and minister to 10 people? Well, I'd go, God. God says, really? Well, yeah. Do you want me to go? Now, the Lord wasn't speaking to my heart to leave, and I'm thankful for that. But the Lord was challenging me again, saying, did you really mean it when you said I'll serve you in obscurity or greatness? God, it doesn't matter to me if you use me to, you know, touch thousands of lives. It doesn't matter to me if you choose me to touch 2 lives. I'm yours. And I will live wholeheartedly for you. I will give myself to you 100%. See, your life and my life, we're to be living sacrifices. And a sacrifice in the Old Testament times, they would slaughter the animal and blood was everywhere. They'd put blood on the priest's thumbs, on their ears. They would put blood on their big toes. They would sprinkle blood off of bushes onto the crowds of the people. They would smear blood on the horns of the altar. There was blood everywhere when you walked in. It was speaking of the severity of sin, that it's not something that can be taken lightly. But then they would put that animal on the altar. They would light a fire and it would begin to cook. And the smoke of that sacrifice would go up towards heaven so that if you were walking by outside, you could see the smoke of the sacrifice going up. The Bible talks about the sweet-smelling aroma to God. Can you imagine having a tent downwind from the tabernacle? Someone's sacrificing a lamb. It sure smells pretty good to us, right? God says it's a sweet-smelling aroma to me, but it's not a sweet-smelling aroma to God because it's barbecue. It's a sweet-smelling aroma to us because it's barbecue. But to God, it was the sacrifice. That lamb could have been used to feed a family. That lamb could have been used to buy money. So someone could have gone out and, you know, pursued their habit. But instead, they gave that lamb to God. And that lamb was consumed and burned up and fell down into the ashes. So it was all consumed as a gift to God. Our lives could be consumed for ourselves. Our lives could be consumed so we can buy food. Our lives could be consumed so we can spend time doing our habits. Nothing wrong with habits, by the way. But our lives could be consumed doing those things. But God says, will you lay your life on the altar? Wouldn't you rather be consumed for him? Wouldn't you rather have your life mean something, living over the sun, living up of the things? Ephesians says, we are not citizens of this earth, but we are citizens in heaven. Therefore, do not be mindful of the things of this earth, but be mindful of the things of heaven. Where you say, Lord, here it is. It's my life. For better, for worse, whatever you have for me, whatever you want me to go, whatever you want me to do, if it's to minister to one person or minister to 20,000, I don't care. I'm yours and I want my life to be consumed for you. Some of you guys say, I don't want to do that. I like my life. Okay, well, you like your life and your life's going to be consumed for whatever you go for. See, you're going to labor, you're working away and the sun's going up and down and the wind's going around, the rain's coming down and you're getting older and older and older and older. Finally, you die and then you decay in dust and you go away. If you could all see it in a movie and fast forward, kind of like the mummy, just and in the end, you look back and go, okay, there it is. That's my life. Someday, there you are in the grave or in the urn that's up on somebody's mantle place. Who was that? It's my great-grandma. She lived in Tucson, Arizona. God says, I'd rather have you consumed for me. And you know what? That's where we're satisfied. That's the life that is fulfilling. Whether we, you know, and we still go from difficulty to difficulty. We could still say that men live lives of quiet desperation. There's still tough times. Jesus said, in this world, you will have tribulation. But we know we're living for something that matters. We know we've given it to him. Maybe it's time for us today to say to him once again, here I am, Lord. I don't want to just live my life for myself. I want to live my life for you. I want to be a part of this rat race. I want to be a part of what you want me to do, that there can be significance, that my life would be that sweet-smelling aroma to you. And as we pray now, we want to give ourselves to the Lord in that way. Let's stand up and pray.